Morning, everybody. Hello. Nice to see you all here. And we're just getting started as people join us. We're doing it as a meeting, not a webinar this morning, so we can see you. If we find that the Wi-Fi starts going wobbly, we might take everybody's videos off. So apologies in advance for that, if that's the case. We are delighted to be joined by Sophie Howe this morning. I'm going to do some introductions and get going. I'm Auriel Miller, the director of the IWA, Wales is the Union Independent Think Tank. I'm chairing today's conversation on behalf of the Live Learning Partnership, which is a group of 10 organisations co-led by the IWA and the Wales Cooperative Centre. The other members of the partnership are Business in the Community, Cardiff Business School, Care Forum Wales, Community Housing Cymru, Cymorth Cymru, the Ethnic Minorities and Youth Support Team East, Wales Council for Voluntary Action, and ERLAB, Cardiff University and NESTA Collaboration. The IWA is really pleased to acknowledge the National Lottery Community Fund for their contribution towards enabling us to get this project off the ground. A little bit of housekeeping, do please chat as much as you like in the chat. Just remember everything's recorded. We'll be putting everything on the on our YouTube afterwards, and we'll be keeping to an hour to avoid Zoom overload or tech overload, whatever it is, because it's a bit much sometimes. Other members of the partnership are going to be sharing some of the main points that have come through the stories so far that we've collected and analysed. And like I said, we're delighted to be joined by Sophie Howe, Future Generations Commissioner, who's going to reflect on what she's heard today. So welcome, Sophie. First of all, though, over to Karen Lewis of the Wales Cooperative Centre, who is going to just do a quick reminder, and I am going to share my screen before I forget. Here we go.
Thanks, Auriel. Morning, everyone. Welcome. As Auriel said, so I'm Karen Lewis. I'm a director of the Wales Cooperative Centre, and we're delighted to be lead partner in this really exciting partnership. I'm just going to give a very quick whistle-stop tour of where we're at and before I hand over to Sophie, and hopefully listen to the thoughts and the reflections of the rest of you when we've given you a bit of a taste of what we've been doing. So since last July, when I actually wrote this, I thought, last July, was it the year before? I can't actually remember because everything has just become a blur. But yes, it was July of last year. We started gathering stories of people's experiences during the pandemic. We started off predominantly with each of us as partner organisations asking our own staff and colleagues, and gradually over the following months we've sent the tool out further to our members and to colleagues and other stakeholders. So the tool that we're using for this is called SenseMaker. And it's not a traditional survey tool. It's very different. It was developed, I think, out of the Canevin program that comes out of Bangor University and Dave Snowden. And really the idea of this tool is that it allows us to pull together some learning from the messier issues in society. So it's not a straightforward yes, no survey tool. It's very much a narrative research tool. So it allows people to share stories of experience and gives us some very rich data, which we'll talk a little bit more about later in the session. So we've looked at the data in two phases. Phase one, July to October, and phase two, November to January. And we're grateful to the analysts who've helped us with this, because we're all very much doing this on a bit of a shoestring, all of us doing it on top of the day job. So people are piling in to help us. And Monmouthshire, Link, Newydd, Family and Mellon, and Michael Muthukrishna from the London School of Economics have all helped us, along with, in the early days, colleagues at ERLAB, which is the collaboration between NESTA and Cardiff University. Next slide, please. I'm doing my Chris Whitty, as I said earlier. Thank you. So triads, as I, We've got two ways of looking at data within SenseMaker and of people who are actually taking part looking at the data themselves. So triads allow us to look at something in a triangular form. So rather than just a straightforward yes or no question, we're looking at how people are responding within a three-cornered sort of context, really. So if you look at where we were in phase one and phase two, and apologies if you haven't seen triads before, it can look a bit sort of overwhelming, but if you get chance to get into SenseMaker later on, you'll get the sense of what we're looking at here. But the main thing to look at is the numbers, the percentages and the dots. And it gives you a sense of in phase one and in phase two, most of the responses and the stories were coming down in that sort of bottom left-hand point of the triangle, which is people in society. And what we were finding and we're still finding is most of the stories and the experiences that were coming up were focused on people themselves, their lives and their local communities and society. A little bit on the natural environment as well, but very little focus on economic stories. So that, I think, was quite an interesting finding for us. Thanks, Oriel. And similarly, so the other way of looking at the data is a dyad, and that's just really a binary sort of a visual. So you can see here, and this was quite early on, looking at the impact. We asked people to talk about the impact of the story that they were sharing, and you can see, not unsurprisingly, that it was very, very much weighted towards the impact being significant. So people were definitely feeling that throughout the pandemic, and this data is from the earlier stage, that it was very significant what they were seeing, what they were feeling. It wasn't something small in their lives or in society. And we'll talk a little bit more later about how the data has continued, but I think there's still very much a strong sense that the experience that we've all gone through and the people who responded during the pandemic has been significant. So that's just a sort of a very quick introduction to what we've been doing. We will unpick some of it later on. But I guess the main thing for us about this piece of work was that we wanted to come up with a new way of listening and learning. We're calling ourselves the Live Learning Partnership. Our ambition is to be listening and learning as we go along. So I'd now like to hand over to Sophie to just talk us through a little bit about why listening is important, and particularly why this tool can help us to listen in fresh ways. So Sophie Howe, our Future Generations Commissioner for Wales, over to you. Thank you.
Thanks, Karen, for that introduction, and you know, particularly for the introduction to SenseMaker, which is a tool that I've used on a number of occasions in my office, and in fact, we used it for our last conversation about our Future Wales, which informed my Future Generations report. But it can, you know, can take a little bit of getting used to, but once you really sort of get into it, then you're absolutely right. The data and the information that it provides is really rich, and not the sort of thing that you would get from other survey type tools. So why is it so important to listen? Well, the Dalai Lama said, when you talk, you're only repeating what you know, but if you listen, you may learn something new, and it's important for us all to learn something new. Why is that kind of critically important now? Because we're at a moment of time where everything really that we know or our normal is being completely turned on its head. And so we're going to need to find new solutions to some of the challenges that are facing us. We also need to be listening. So we need to be listening to people who might be able to help us with those new solutions. And I often talk about the need to sort of engage the unusual suspect. So how are we getting the, you know, the artists talking to the scientists and the engineers, talking to the creatives and the doctor, talking to the land management expert? Because when you start bringing all of those different people together and listening to their perspective and joining the dots between the issues that might be in your world, then I think we start to potentially see some new, exciting and innovative solutions. But I think there's another critical reason why we need to be listening. And that's because in Wales, I think that we are, you know, lucky that we have some quite significant progressive policy and legislation. And certainly I'd say that the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act fits into that category. But we do have a significant problem with the implementation gap. So the ability of policy and legislation to flow down to actually making a change on the ground is still a massive challenge here in Wales. And I'm not saying it's a challenge just in Wales, it's a challenge for many governments. But how are we going to get around that? You know, when the Future Generations was passed, the United Nations said, we hope what Wales is doing today, the world will do tomorrow. That's great. But they also said then, action more than words is the hope for future generations. And it's that part, that kind of action more than words. So we've written the words down in our legislation. Everyone knows what that kind of legislative and policy framework is. But how do we translate that into action? And the only way we're going to translate that into action is by understanding what that looks like for people on the ground. What is it that helps them and what is it that hinders them from doing good things? When have they managed to navigate a system or find a way of doing good things, and what were the factors that enabled them to do that? Last week I spoke to the NHS Finance Academy, and I was telling people just before everyone joined the call that I'd also spent a few weeks prior to that speaking to myself for 45 minutes.
I'm not sure if we've just lost Sophie or who's been frozen. Karen, can you hear me?
I can hear you. I can't see Sophie.
No, so I think we've lost Sophie. So we'll come back to Sophie at the end, and we'll move straight into Dan, please. We're going to each different parts of the partnership are going to speak about different themes. So, Dan, let's come to you first for talking about sentiment analysis. So,
okay. Hopefully everyone can hear me. So yeah, hi, I'm Daniel Roberts. I'm the Policy and Research Officer at the Wales Cooperative Centre. Lakshmi said already this morning, we joined the Live Learning Partnership because we know that to achieve the ambitions that we have for Wales and the Welsh economy over the next few years, we need to have this shift in focus towards wellbeing. And as we shift the purpose and objective of the economy to this more cooperative approach, The way that we measure the health of our economy and communities and the impact of our policies will have to shift too. And this is what Sentimaker and the cross-sector partnership allows us to do, to understand these stories. And I think that's essential for understanding how Welsh people have experienced the past year or so. And it's this rich qualitative data that can play a hugely important role in that, to make sure that the way that we recover from COVID-19 is relevant to the well-being of people in Wales, how their lives have changed, and what we can learn from these changes. So we're really grateful to Michael from London School of Economics, who's provided this initial analysis of the data that's been collected so far. I think first of all, it's worth pointing out that obviously, you know, we're still collecting data, and the more stories that we get, the richer the data will be, the stronger it will be. So obviously, anyone listening this morning, I'd urge them to get involved, share their stories on the link, and promote this tool within their networks as well. And I think that Michael is attending today. Hopefully he's here. So I'm sure if there's anyone who's got any questions about this analysis or wants to discuss it further, I'm sure he'll be more than happy to do that. Michael has used a sentiment analysis to explore how the words and languages used in the stories have changed over time across different stages of restrictions, across different lockdowns. And then the language has been categorized as either positive, negative, or neutral. And then you can also see if it's been subcategorized beyond that as well. And from the data that we've had so far, we've got some initial trends and some emerging conclusions. So they found that over time, as more restrictions were being introduced to deal with the rising cases in the autumn of 2020, there was a shift towards more negative language than had been used previously. And throughout this period, you know, we've had some positive stories and positive changes to the way people have lived, such as, you know, benefits of working from home, for example. But over time, there's been a shift towards these more negative stories and more negative experiences. And alongside this, SenseMaker allows us to dig a bit deeper. And you can see that there's been a shift in the responses towards more reactive rather than proactive. And people describing their stories as being adapting to circumstances rather than innovation. And I think one of the crucial things for me is that respondents have stated that they expect the post-COVID world to be different to the one that came before, but they actually aspire for that to be even more radical. And we can see some examples of how things have changed in the subcategories of sentiments as well. I think it's interesting that the data suggests that levels of trust have actually increased as the year have gone on. And as you'd expect, the levels of surprise have decreased. You know, people may be getting used to living with these sort of restrictions that would have been so unimaginable, you know, a year ago. But it is concerning to see this rise in negative emotions alongside sentiments like disgust and sadness. And then if we go on to the next slide, we can see a simple word cloud of the sentiments that have been expressed. And, you know, you can see words that you'd expect, like pandemic, understanding, importance. But we can also see some of the key themes that are coming through, you know, words like money, weight and learning, and homelessness as well, which is obviously a crucial issue and might reflect the people who've participated so far. So if you think about, you know, I think that these trends are interesting in their own right, but if we think about the implications as well, you know, how is this shift towards more negative feelings going to impact the way that communities move on from the pandemic? And I think, this is evidence that we need policy in the public sphere to rebuild the resilience and positivity that were in communities during the first wave of the pandemic. So these are the stories that we've collected so far through SenseMaker, and we're really appreciative of it, to the work of the analysts that's been done already. And I think, you know, this sort of sentiment analysis can really shine a light on the way Wales has experienced COVID-19 and what we need to do to rebuild. So I'm now going to hand over to Ed from Community Housing Cymru, who I think has got more analysis that we can learn from.
Lovely. Thank you, Dan. Hello, everybody. Good morning. Yes, I'm Edwina and I work for Community Housing Cymru. So we're the membership body for housing associations in Wales. I'm going to build on what Dan has said, and then I'm going to hand to Sue, who's going to talk about resilience. So nice link up right through the whole presentation, hopefully. So my background is comms, so I'm really interested in the language that people are using, and, you know, it's a real privilege to hear the stories and to be able to have a look at the stories that we are gathering and hear how the pandemic is impacting on people. So the work that I'm presenting is the work of our analysts. So again, just to say thank you to them, it's their work I'm presenting, so hopefully I'll do it justice. And I'm going to add a little bit more colour, I suppose, to what Dan has said. So in terms of the lovely visuals that he's presented, more in terms of kind of the stories that are coming through. So in terms of the very positive and positive stories, you can see here on this slide that combined they have fallen in phase two to 46% from around 56%. And as Dan alluded to, the very negative and negative stories combined remain about 30%. However, very negative stories have gained ground on the negative stories. You can see as well that neutral stories have gone up slightly from 11% to 13%. But it's been challenging, I think, to determine whether these stories are truly neutral, because when you dig down into them a little bit further, there are a few positives and a few negatives in there as well. But there definitely does seem to be a shift more towards the negative overall in phase two, and really pessimism about the long term effect and struggles working from home as the situation continues longer than any of us would have anticipated. Next slide, please, Oriel. So I'm going to talk through some of the positive and very positive stories. We've said that there is a shift towards the negative, and I'll come on to that, but there's lots of positives in there and very positive as well. So in phase two, the main theme are the benefits really from the change in attitudes towards working from home. Specifically flexibility around working patterns and really a shift in emphasis from work being somewhere that you go to being something that you do, regardless of location and timing. So people are seeing that as a real positive. This remains in keeping with phase one, but with slightly more emphasis on the positives around the working life rather than the extracurricular activities. A lot of what we were finding in phase one was the positivity around the weather and being able to get out on, at lunchtime or do a walk in the morning or see family and friends. But obviously, if restrictions have I suppose tightened, more emphasis is around work and life in this phase. The language and tone, I think, between both phases has been very, very different. Phase two responses have been much shorter and more reflective. There's greater use of the past tense, so phrases such as I have or we will, and that really contrasts with more forward-looking I am or we will be terminology used in phase one. And again, you know, that's probably not surprising given that we're further into the pandemic and, dare I say it, people getting used to the new normal, if you like. Improvements to mental health and well-being is a recurrent theme, with respondents feeling happier that the changes that have been made because of the pandemic are having a positive impact on different aspects of their lives. And these tie in with positive responses to flexible working and the indirect benefits such as less time commuting, more time to spend with family and friends, more time to exercise, take up a new project, etc. Mentions of mental health and well-being in phase two are 100% positive, whereas in phase one, whilst the overall stories are categorised as very positive, there were some narratives in there which could make it appear to be neutral or slightly negative. Both phases mentioned working from home, having to adapt, but looking at the positives, there was, however, a change in language. So in phase one, a greater sense of urgency, firefighting type responses, while in phase two, the language is much softer and less tense. And again, that's just probably because we're further into the pandemic. And there is probably now a bit of an acceptance, actually, that this is the way that, that things are. So less tense and softer language as opposed to firefighting type responses, as you know, we were starting out in phase one. In terms of negative and very negative then, so the main theme of the negative stories, and you're all probably going to be able to relate to this, is the lack of the in-person contact with colleagues and with tenants and with people that you would come into contact with on a day-to-day basis. Another sense of frustration is waiting for responses from people, causing a lot of negative feelings, and then lack of boundaries between home and work. There is less mention of negative impact on mental health and well-being, although the couple of things and examples I've just given there will undoubtedly have an impact on people's mental health and well-being. The number of very negative stories rose from 5% to 11%. There's a real sense of pessimism in the titles that people are attributing to their stories. So titles such as bleak new reality, loneliness. And it appears that the lack of face-to-face contact, and be that family, friends, colleagues, tenants, etc., is the main issue here. The theme emerging from stories about work highlight the disruption to processes, lack or late responses, or the breakdown of work relationships. And the very negative stories in the first phase also focused on loneliness and lack of face-to-face contact, but we're definitely seeing a ramp up of this in phase two. And I think in phase two, there's an increased worry about the long-term impact that this is going to have and the long-term effects in terms of that professional relationship breakdown. So that's a whistle stop in terms of some of the stories that are coming through, and hopefully you've had a chance to read in the words of the storytellers themselves. So I'm going to hand to Sue now, who's going to talk us through kind of, so what does all of this mean in terms of resilience of our people and our communities?
So thanks, Ed. So I'm Sue Husband from Business in the Community in Wales, and I'm particularly interested in how we become more resilient and use this pandemic as an opportunity to learn and to build back responsibly. And the sentiment and language that people have shared through their stories has led us to consider the resilience of people through this pandemic. And the shift towards more negative language, as Dan shared, and stories being categorised as more reactive and than proactive over time. Perhaps reflects the unplanned nature of the change for everyone, such as those either having to still go to work or those forced to work from home. And whilst people have expressed both challenges and benefits from those enforced changes of behaviour and work, more thought and consideration needs to be given to ensure we minimise the negative impact on individuals. As Ed's just shared, there does seem to be a shift towards the more negative language overall in phase two. and some pessimism expressed about the struggles caused by the new ways of working and living from home, and importantly, the long-term effect of this change and impact on people's resilience. I looked at a dictionary definition of resilience, and it's that people and things that are resilient are able to recover easily and quickly from unpleasant or damaging events. And something that's resilient is strong and not easily damaged. And we've seen what resilience there was really tested during this pandemic. And I think we will have all experienced this personally at some point, or sometimes several points during the pandemic, you know, our resilience really tested. And I'll paraphrase one of the stories which really sums this up. The longer people are working from home, the more impact changes. People were quite positive at first. As time's gone on, I'm finding it more of a mental struggle. Some days I find it hard to stay motivated and focused and don't feel I've achieved anything. And I think that that story probably rings true either with us personally or for the experience of some of people close to us. So Auriel, if I could have the next slide, please. There's recognition from the stories we've collected that people are aware of their levels of resilience and that they've been tested during this time. For some, they may have been strengthened as a result of COVID, or the recognition that they need building up. For many, there's been a blurring between work and home life. So whilst over time, the collated stories do show that people have been less surprised and have less fear, their positivity is waning. And whilst trust has built, people are expressing more sadness and negative sentiment is growing. So whilst this experience is becoming, could describe it as more familiar, it doesn't make it any less impactful. Actually, the stories would suggest that people's resilience is really being tested. And we've probably seen in our own personal experiences the initial shock of the impact of COVID, followed by some kind of acceptance and a sense of almost normalizing and perhaps seeing it as an opportunity for change, to it becoming harder to deal with over time as personal stores of resilience are tested, through to where we are now. And I think there's a growing sense of just wanting to get back to some kind of new and better normal and making sure that we do learn from this experience. And if I could have the next slide. So what does this mean for us and the population at large? Well, we've set out for this to be a live learning partnership, and there are some positive things that people have learned already. So whilst we can't draw too much from the 160 plus stories we've collected to date, we can reflect on what we have heard and on our own personal experiences about the importance of adapting, how important communication is, how we've got to invest in relationships and develop coping mechanisms, and the need for personal development and building up of resilience. And one definition of resilience is the ability of a substance or object to spring back into shape. And that's the one thing I think that's come through loud and clear, is not going to go back to the old shape, the normal ways of doing things, but so important that we actually do learn from this experience and be stronger and fitter for the future as a result. Back to you, Auriel.
I'm on mute, there we go, and I'm back on video, fantastic. Thanks very much indeed, Karen, Dan, Ed, and Sue. Sophie, I know you've had Wi-Fi hassles, and it was typical that it happened just as you were talking about Wi-Fi hassles. I'm gonna bring you back in now to reflect on some of the things that you've heard. Let's just take the screen sharing off for a minute and see if that makes it easier. I know you've moved room, but I can see you, brilliant. What do you think? I mean, some of this obviously isn't gonna be new. We've all been through this in very different ways, but what we're seeing here is some evidence of not just what people are saying, but how they're saying it and what that means for them in terms of their feelings, their emotions, their personal resilience. Sophie, can you hear me?
I'm dropping in and out. I'm really sorry about this.
Don't worry. I'll ask you again. We're just saying that some of the things that people are saying won't be new, but what we're hearing, what we can tell from the SenseMaker analysis, is people's feelings about what's happening to them and how they feel about the future and their ability to cope with it and adapt to it, that is changing. So there's some really interesting stuff coming through there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, just listening to in there, I mean, I possibly could have written a lot of that, you know, if I was writing a diary myself. So I think we all kind of recognise that kind of shift. I think the early phases of lockdown, it was a bit like a prolonged snow day, wasn't it? Which is kind of, you know, fun when you have a snow day. Actually, if it goes on for too long, then it actually becomes a real pain in the neck and the disruption and so on and so on. What I think is interesting, however, are the things that people referred to when they were more positive. And how do we get to a position where we retain, you know, there's lots of discussion about retaining the good and, you know, and ditching the bad in terms of the kind of COVID learning. And the things that I picked up from there is, you know, some of the indirect benefits of working from home. So spending more time with family and friends, being able to exercise and so on, perhaps having a better work-life balance. But then as time has sort of shifted on, some of those positives have kind of moved away. So how do we sort of bring them back and retain them as we move out of restrictions and so on? And I think that, you know, there are some, you know, ideas that we should be considering in that regard. You know, what if we were all working a reduced working week? What if there was a universal basic income so that people didn't have to worry about that income security as much? What if, you know, everyone who benefited from being able to access public open space and nature, you know, what if that was kind of universal and not just, you know, an advantage that people in more affluent areas have? So I think that there are some things that we can take from that and kind of learn in terms of, you know, how we reconstruct post-COVID.
Thank you. Let's pick up on some of the questions that are coming through on the chat as well. So I'll just move my screen around so I can see things. Okay, some of the things, there's a question here which is how we've promoted the tool so far. I think it's safe to say we've done it by fits and starts with the rest of the Live Learning Partnership team. This is something that we don't have a particular person working on it, so we are hoping to get some funding to have somebody to coordinate and drive it. So we've done it through our various networks on top of things. The way it's set up is that each organisation in the partnership's got their own URL, so you can just dive into what's coming in through your own networks, and then you're responsible for redacting that by the end of each month, so that then you can make it publicly available. And I know Beth Smith from Cognitive Edge is on the call today as well, because she's working on a tool that makes the publicly available data super easy to both use. So we want to make it publicly available, so that's why all personal information is redacted, so that anybody could use it, because you can search by local authority, you can search by kind of activity that somebody's doing, you can search by any of the tags or any of the questions that have been used that follow on from the main question at the top of the questionnaire. So that's how we've been promoting it, essentially through social media and through our own networks, and mainly because of lack of resources to do anything further on from that. We've got another question about who do you think is taking part so far, and Karen, do you want to talk to that one?
Yeah, thanks, Auriel.
Sorry. I meant to mute myself, not you. Sorry, Karen.
That's fine. I tried to reply. I can't see Duncan, but I know you're there somewhere. I tried to reply a little bit, Duncan, to what you were raising, because I think it's a really good question. It's a couple of things. Firstly, this hasn't been done in a traditional sort of research methodological approach in terms of sampling and random controlled trials. It's supposed to do exactly the opposite. So it's supposed, what we're trying to do is to spread the net wide and get stories coming through in a less traditional way. But the point I'd just like to pick up, Aurel, and I'd really like to hear people's thoughts on this really, is we had discussions quite early on around the whole issue of people needing to be digitally capable to fill this in. Obviously, it's close to my heart. I'm a director at the Wales Cooperative Centre. For 15 years, we've led Welsh Government's digital inclusion programme. So it's very close to our heart to make sure that we're hearing from all the voices. We don't have an easy answer to that. And I think Ed posted something in there to say, you know, there's a bit of a tension here that if it was assisted digital and people were helping people to fill in SenseMaker, then is there a bias coming into the answers? So I'm throwing that out. I'd like to hear if people have any thoughts, because I think it's fair to say it's something we've wrangled with. But going back to how we've, so far, we've basically, the data that's come in has come through a very informal network that we've, as Aurel said, we've all been, we've established sort of through our organisations. But from me today, one of the purposes of this session is really a plea to all of you and, you know, your colleagues, your stakeholders. We want this to go further. We are all doing it on top of the day job, as Aurel said. We think this is a great tool that could give us a lot of learning, but we don't have resources to do that on our own, although we're looking to bring in one person to help. So I guess really today we were hoping to hear from other individuals and organisations your thoughts on how perhaps you could take this further or where else we could take it. Aurel, I've completely gone off piste from what you asked me to talk about.
Absolutely fine. I think there are two things to know. One is, yes, you can do it on a desktop, but you can also do it on a phone. So if you do it on a phone, you can stop and come back to it later. So that's often easier if you're out and about. We don't actually know who's filling it in, because one of the point of it is it's anonymous and people don't share who they are and their email addresses. It's about where they are across the country. And we have had, you know, we've had some really interesting feedback from people saying, is it just about people in jobs? Well, no, you know, we think we've got enough options of people who either aren't in work because they don't have a job, or because they've got caring responsibilities, or they're retired, or whatever. I think there was one, what was the, it'll come back into me in a minute's time. Let's just go to the next question for now. So plans for widening the audience and accessibility. This has been a kind of learning by doing kind of project so far. One of the reasons, oh, this is what I want to say, one of the reasons why the questions are as they are is we tried to mirror as much as possible what what Audit Wales did with their using the same tool for the public bodies that they are responsible for auditing. And Chris Bolton, who's here from Audit Wales, maybe Chris, you could talk a little bit about this as well, because our original idea was to see if we could mirror if Audit Wales were asking public sector organisations how the shifts were happening and changing with far more resources than we have. But that's not a dig, Chris, it's just an acknowledgement of it. We were concerned about, well, who's asking all the people that those organisations are also commissioning further on down the line? How are we getting a sense about that? So I think that's that was one of our concerns. Chris, do you want to pick up from that?
Am I off mute?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's a really important point, and I think it comes back to some of the stuff I saw in the chat there. We're only as good as our networks we connect to. So the network of the Live Learning Partnerships, a very different network to who Audit Wales's auditors connect to. But the information we gather, there's things we can pull out of those sets. So we've not quite got there yet in linking our sets of data. But the fact we've collected it in the same way allows that to happen. And it's interesting, some of the things you're picking up are complementary to some of the similar to the types of things we've been seeing through our networks. Went back last sort of June, July, August, we did do another trial with this, and it was working with some NHS people. Again, their network was very different, and it went out as a trial with the Bevan Commission. and into some frontline staff. And it was just interesting looking at the comparison of what you get from different groupings. Auditors at that time were telling very factual auditor type stories, statements of this is happening in the world, this is what we've seen. The stuff that came out of the work that the Bevan Commission was the sort of blood and guts of the front line, that there were people telling very much more visceral stories of what it was like. And but that's just a reflection of who the networks you go. So that point you're making, how we spread the net and use it to look at like a different lens. So the auditor lens is different from the live learning partnerships lens, different to a housing association, different to what people, but if you start to look at them together, you start to see different pictures. I think that's the important point of getting, not there's not one network that's going to cover all of Wales for everything. We have to use everyone's networks to get into different spaces, if that makes any sense, Aurel.
Thanks, Chris. And I think one of our, you know, one of our concerns was, you know, early on, a lot of those conversations were saying very specifically within different sectors, and there was nothing that was linking things across sectors. So that was what we were, that was absolutely what we were trying to do. And though, you know, we totally realise it's not perfect yet, and that's why we wanted to have the conversation and keep the ball rolling. We didn't know how far this would go, and it's. In a way, to be perfectly honest, we've bitten off quite a lot here trying to make this happen. And so what we want to do is think about how do we get it to the next stage and the next level, whether people want to be members of the kind of partnership itself, crunching through the GDPR stuff with us that we've, you know, took time to sort of get all of that kind of stuff sorted in an MOU early on, as well as getting out and about, both virtually and in person. Karen, I can see your hands up.
Thanks, Aurel. Yeah, I just wanted to pick up because Duncan has posted in the chat again, and I think this is really important. Chris touched a bit on it there, and we know that we have had stories through from NHS frontline workers. But I think the point that Duncan makes here, I'm just reading it, exclusion isn't just about ICT. Yeah. There's a parallel universe of people going out to risk their lives. And we're not just talking about health and social care here. We're talking about the gig economy. We're talking about people in factories, et cetera, et cetera. So I just, you know, I'm just making another plea, anyone, you know, because we need to be accessing these stories, because these are the ones that, thinking particularly Sophie for your, you know, your sort of remit, these are the stories that don't get surfaced, you know, these are not the people who are out there on social media, etc. So any help or support, we completely agree with Duncan, we need to be surfacing these stories because this is really important learning for us. So any help would be much appreciated. Thank you.
So one of the things that we're trying to do, thanks Karen, with this, was trying not to filter stories. So it's about people saying what they want to say, and then we'll make it publicly available and share it also with Welsh Government. I know there's a question about who are we sharing it with. Beth, are you still on the line? I can't see you in the first page. Maybe you might be able to talk about the oral data.
I am here, yeah.
You're there, brilliant.
So if people are using the app as opposed to the website collector, then we can enable audio collection instead of the written text. And because everything is analysed using the same framework, all of the data is held in common. So we can actually start to use things like video, audio and visuals and imagery as the primary piece of data. And then to get people to kind of unpack that through the signification, so through the triads and the additional questions. So we can start to look at different formats of data and holding it all in common to see, and just to make things more accessible and potentially a bit more creative as well.
Thank you, that's really handy. I can see in the chat there's a question from a comment about Christopher, working in a magistrate's court. So Christopher, I really hope you're going to fill in, and I can see you now, so I'm going to wave. Maybe you can fill in your story too and tell us about how that worked or didn't work for you, because it'd be great to share it. The way that we want to use it, and I know you asked this question about how we're going to use, what we're going to do with the data. I guess three ways. One is to kind of build a bank of information that people can use wherever they are, whatever they they're doing. We make no bones about what people should be using it for, but it's about gathering this, because this is, you know, this is a moment in history, isn't it? We're still living through this moment in history, and this moment in history is not going to stop anytime soon. We've got to build a better future coming out of this. So listening to that, and you forget as time goes on how you felt at a particular moment, and gathering and storing that kind of stuff is really important. So that's one thing. And secondly, both academics and other researchers in the future will need somewhere. We think this is a really good, it's more of an active depository. The other thing is pulling it through into Welsh Government and the Senedd as well, and committees. So for instance, there was an inquiry on working from home, and some of the evidence that's coming through this already being submitted to that inquiry about what implications and how people are feeling. Some of the citizens' voices as well coming through in a way which is unfiltered by the organisation that's either gathering or representing them. So we thought that was a really good way of getting voices to the top. Beth has offered to do a demonstration of the new workbench, so to show you what that would look like. So Beth, yes, I think the short answer. Let's wing it and see if the tech will work. And give that a go. But I'd really, while you're getting ready to do that, can I just ask everybody, please, can you give us one way in which we could expand the project as well, in terms of getting it out there to people? I know Christopher's just suggested the listening project every week. What else would work as a way of getting it out to people much further and wider? We know we need resources to do that too, but what else could work? Sophie.
Yeah, a couple of points. I mean, I think it would be really interesting to see whether there were opportunities to sort of plug into things like age concern and so on, and some of the befriending services that are taking place, or that, you know, and have kind of ramped up during lockdown. So there's lots of people doing, you know, being paired with perhaps an older and isolated person, and doing phone calls, getting some of those volunteers to perhaps be, you know, having a chat and asking some of those questions, I think would be really interesting. The other thing that I was going to say is how we pair this data, or perhaps how we analyse this data in line with some of the other things that are being done in terms of perceptions, people's perceptions during COVID. So Public Health Wales are doing a weekly, actually, summary in terms of people's views and feelings on particular things. I was in a session with the ONS, the Office of National Statistics, yesterday. They've been doing some similar things. What their data is lacking, however, you've got the kind of, you know, 58% of people think this and so on and so on, but they're kind of lacking those, you know, the nuances of those stories, which I think that SenseMaker can provide. So I think, you know, I'm coming up with all of these ideas and recognizing that, you know, resources are really, really challenging, but almost taking that sort of big data, seeing where it aligns with the SenseMaker findings, and then adding in the kind of richness of the stories that you get from SenseMaker to provide that as an evidence base to policymakers, I think would be hugely rich and hugely useful.
Yeah, so I think there's two things there. Obviously, there is a job to do in terms of coordinating and pushing it out and engaging with people, and there's a job to do also in that kind of live analysis of what else is being learned as we go along, and what does this tell us. So regular communications, Welsh Government comms, special occasions, yeah, all those sorts of things. Okay, any other suggestions coming through from people, or we can go on to the next wellbeing programs to share feelings, a sort of social prescribing, radio and TV. Yeah, I'd love it, Jane. I'd love it if we could be on sort of Good Morning Wales and say, you know, here's a handy link to. Or a QR code. Maybe we get a QR code to go straight to the link, so you don't have to type it in, that kind of stuff. So various things there. There's a question from I didn't see who it came from, actually, I'm afraid. Did the second sample period include duplicated responses from the original responders? respondents, or was it intended to avoid that? We don't know. We don't know if one person has answered 165 times, we think not. But we don't know. We don't know how many times people have replied. And I think that in a way, that's one of the beauties of it. You just don't know. And that's partly because you want to be encouraging people to share their feelings at different points in time as well, because that shifts and changes. And I can see that there's a question about volunteers. Okay, we're going to have to go back and pick up lots of the chat. I can't keep track of it all. There's some really good ideas coming through. But no, Richard, I can see the question was from Richard. We just don't know. I suspect people have got better things to do with their time than put in the same response to something, you know, that they put in a couple of months ago, but who knows. There's a question from Dovrig Williams about resilience seems to be very focused on the self in this feedback. So he'd be interested to know if there's any reflection on the wider systemic influences on resilience in the data. And again, I think that's something that we'd need to dig into a bit more. Sue, are you still on the, I can see you're still on the line. Can you hear me? Do you want to pick up on that question about systemic resilience, please?
Yeah, I think, and maybe not actually through live learning sort of partnership, but I think more broadly, all of us are seeing that everything's being tested, you know, the resilience of everything through this pandemic. And a lot of people who are involved in the group are in the sort of voluntary sector. And I think we've all seen the impact of COVID on that and society's reliance more and more on the voluntary sector. We actually spoke to a number of organisations about a month ago, and one of the things that was coming through was clear that people had sort of eaten into their reserves, their financial reserves. It was harder and harder to raise money at the moment, and the workforce, the impact on the workforce and their well-being. And I think somebody had mentioned earlier on in the chat that we've talked about people working from home and it being difficult, say, with the internet connections and things. But actually, there are so many people who've had to keep going to work. And I think this is where, you know, we're seeing now at 12 months of sustained having to go to work and to deal with all the consequences of that is really testing people's resilience as well. So I think, you know, one of the things that we have to be prepared for now is the almost the stored up demand for the kind of support people will need coming out the other side of this, because they've had to just keep going, and what kind of support people are going to need to actually see them through and help them recover from this. And I think, yeah, Christopher's just posted a note now saying about people have eaten into their resilience reserves. Absolutely. And I think that's what we have to plan for now, is how we build that back up. Because I think some of the voluntary sector, particularly, even though they've kept going through the 12 months, some of those parts of that infrastructure are going to be needed more than ever as we come out the other side. And some of those things where people haven't come forward for support, I think a simple one would be probably Citizens Advice Bureau, where people would normally go in and they feel like they want to have face-to-face support. Some of that will be, there'll be an increased, you know, in demand at the other side of this. So I think resilience is such an important thing, and how we recover from this, but also how we build up our reserves for any future pandemics. So yeah, it's an important element.
I think it's worth, thanks Sue, it's worth saying that, you know, we're feeling our way with this. I guess what would be good to get a sense from everybody, please, if you could just put in the chat what your I know there are obviously caveats, particularly around who we're catching and the self-selecting nature of that in terms of access to it. Could you share just your sense of, do you think this is something which is worth pursuing? We think it is. We realise that, you know, we may be biased as a team working on it together. But do you think this is worth pursuing and really trying to get some resources behind? And if so, is it something that you would be prepared to, you know, sit down with a couple of your friends or your family members or contacts or neighbours and gather some stories as well and start working on that? And Beth, I'm going to come to you to share the workbench. I haven't forgotten. So while you're putting your responses in the chat, please, folks, come on, you can do it too. I know you can. Beth, would you like to, Rian, could you make Beth co-host, please, so she can share her screen? Brilliant.
Cool. Oh, okay, one moment. So this is the new kind of workbench that we're kind of pulling together. So as a new way to display and share the data. So this is kind of like a mission control where we can see everything that's going on. So this is the current amount of stories that we've got, and that will update live. This is the response rate and the days on which they've come in. So we can look at timestamping the information if we just want to look at a particular point in time, whether that's related to a policy or we might recognize a certain pattern happening or a pivot point. And this just gives us a really kind of high level overview of all the data that we've got. So very much like what you've seen so far. We've got a couple of word clouds relating to some of the free text questions that we've got. And everything on here is kind of drag and drop, and we can arrange it and move it around and change sizes of things. And we're starting to look at how we can make different versions of the same dashboard for different audiences, for example. So if I, for example, were to click, so what best describes the organization that you work for? Housing associations. The rest of the data now becomes responsive to housing associations. So what we're looking at now across the piece is all of the data and the patterns from across the housing sector. So we can start to understand each kind of segment of the data and to have bespoke reports for each part of that data set. And then to be able to hop over from the kind of quantitative analytics straight over into the stories. So we can kind of understand both the patterns and the context in which they're happening. So at the moment we're working on making this a resource that you can share and invite other people to be able to browse and use. So dependent upon, you know, interest or kind of geographic location, people can interact with the data set at a level that's most kind of useful and relevant to them, as well as then the kind of partnership, having the full kind of bird's eye view and being able to facilitate connections between potentially unconnected or people who aren't actually currently engaging in kind of shared practice across kind of silos as well. So just as an idea as to where we're getting and how easy it is to be able to say, actually, I just want to look at things that are going on in the County of Swansea. And we can kind of instantly get to the Swansea data through one click and to understand what's going on within that kind of location. So just a really quick whiz tour to see how we're starting to think about navigating and sharing the data as well.
Great, thank you very much indeed. So it gives you a sense of, you can get into it in any way, basically, depending on what matters most to you. So the question now is getting some more resources behind it, spreading it out and engaging more people in it. If you want to join the mailing list for the project, it's a collaborative project, as you've probably gathered by now, do please email us at livelearning@iwa.org.uk and we'll keep you posted on things. I think we're just about to wrap up. We will, Beth, have you got a date for making the new workbench available publicly, please?
I don't have a fixed date at the moment, but it could be within the next month.
Okay, great. So as soon as it is, if you're on our mailing list, you'll get a notification of that. We're really, really grateful to you all for joining us today and giving us some good, great feedback. I'm just going to give you the email address. That's the email address for us all. And thank you very much indeed for joining us. Thank you, Sophie, for your reflections as well, and for ideas of where we could go with it next. Can I ask the Live Learning team just to stick on the line for a minute or two? And I hope that's got people thinking about how else you could contribute to this as well. And what do we need to do to make it even better than it already is? Because we're pretty convinced it's got huge potential. Thanks very much indeed, everybody. Thanks. Bye bye.